Back to Real Perspective, the podcast based on a YouTube channel based on a podcast. I'm your co-host, MJ Smith.
I'm Michael Morey.
And I'm Missy Lonsinger.
And this week we're continuing our formative filmography series with a pick from Mike. It is 1991's Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, which is available to watch on HBO Max if you are here in the States.
Just Max, MJ, just Max.
Star Trek movie. No, never. I call it HBO still.
So do I.
It's the sixth adventure of the original cast of the original series of Star Trek, and an encounter they have with the Klingons. It is very much a Cold War allegory, which we will talk about. Based on an idea of Leonard Nimoy being like, what if we did one that was the Cold War?
pretty much.
Yep. Written and directed by Nicholas Meyer, the guy who made Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. And they essentially, Kirk and co are tasked with escorting some Klingons to back to Earth for a conference, and things go awry, and the crew of the Enterprise gets framed for attacking the Klingons that they were supposed to be helping, and espionage and spy stuff ensue from there, leading to a conspiracy that goes kind of all the way to the top, sort of. It's some Star Trek stuff made right before Gene Roddenberry's death. Like he died like 3 days after approving the final cut or something. Right before. But Mike, why did you pick Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country as one of your formative filmography picks?
So, I know I picked it knowing that it's not going to measure up to something like Network. You know, obviously Network is in the top 10, top 20, like movie of all time, you know, kind of film. But I think I picked it because I wanted to do something a little more off the wall and different for me. I mean, obviously they're probably bigger movies that have had bigger impacts on me. But I wanted to go with something a little more obscure. And I also thought about doing Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan, but we've already talked about that over the course of our podcasts. And I wanted to choose this one because I think it's, first of all, it's maybe the first movie I ever saw in a theater. I was like 3.5 when I saw it.
Okay.
I actually remember like watching it. I remember like the purple blood and stuff like that.
And
I think I had my eyes covered during that scene. My dad covered my eyes. I remember seeing that. Beyond that though, I think something about this movie that I really enjoy, I think, is emblematic of kind of my tastes and my storytelling sensibilities, is how Star Trek in general, you know, Wrath of Khan can also apply to this, but, you know, this movie especially is a vehicle for telling allegories.
Yeah.
It's not just a sci-fi movie. You know, it's a Cold War movie. It's a spy movie. It's there's a courtroom drama segment.
It turns into a Klingon courtroom drama.
So much of this movie like is me, actually. Now that I think about it, but what I really like about it, and you know, Star Trek, but also you know, fantasy and sci-fi, is how we can use these things, these fantastical worlds and stuff like that, as a lens with which to go and view our world and our political situation. And so, you know, this movie is obviously about the fall of the Berlin Wall, the collapse of the Soviet Union. How did we go about trying to go and reconcile with the former Soviet Union? And also now weirdly it's relevant again because Russia has kind of become the enemy of the United States all over again.
That depends on which president you ask, Mike.
Touche. But to me, I'm really like inspired by that kind of ability to go and use these characters who are very malleable, right? You know, Kirk is a character who's well-defined through other things, but then have him approach like these kind of concepts through his lens. And so I kind of use my own writing and movies and stuff like that as a way of exploring ideas. And so, I think this is a really good example of how that can be done. Because I think it's also just a well-made, like, entertaining movie. You know, like I said, it's not network, guys. But,
right.
You know, and I'm sure we can get into some flaws of it. But it's also really charming and fun. And also something to say. So, I mean, that to me is like an ideal four quadrant movie, you know? Sure. It appeals to everybody and has something to say while doing it.
Yeah. So I just come and visit Star Trek every once in a while. My relationship with Star Trek.
When I impose it on you.
mainly through Mike. The only other time was when I was on Open Pike Night to talk about like an episode of Brave New World, Strange New Worlds in season one. And that was just because I'm friends with one of the co-hosts of that too. And the thing about being a Star Trek tourist is that you only see the good stuff.
Oh, that's fair.
Yeah, because they've already seen the bad stuff, so they tell you which ones to watch so that you don't think they're an insane person for liking this thing. please report one of the good ones again. Nice. I really liked this movie a lot. I thought the performances were all pretty good. Bones may be one of my all-time favorite characters in anything.
I really
love that guy a lot. Like, kind of any version of him. I really like Carl Urban in that role too. Mm-hmm. Like, I think he's great. He's the best part of
Bones
those.
Is a great character.
Calvin verse. But I just love how how no shit Sherlock some of the stuff he says in this movie is. Like, he's just there to say stuff that the audience is thinking, and it's really funny to watch him say that. And like, having those two be the ones that go to space jail is a brilliant decision.
Yes.
I thought the movie was edited really well. There's like really cool cuts to like characters that they're talking about in the previous scene. And like, it just like the way it builds is really great. I think the script is pretty good. It's a little clunky in places. I think the camera work is really good throughout. There's lots of cool shots of the bridge in this movie. Like, they really locked in like how to use the geography of the bridge. I think it's paced really well. Like, it does, a lot of stuff happens in this movie.
Yeah, actually.
And it does not feel like it's too complicated or 2 hours. Like, it feels both breezy and like dense at the same time, which I appreciated. And yeah, it's always interesting to come and visit Star Trek as like someone on the outside to see the sort of social commentary they were talking about, that they were pushing forward in that media and with that property at the time that the stuff was made. So yeah, it's a good movie.
I also thought it was a good movie. I'm like somewhere between, I think, you, MJ, and Mike, because like, I'm definitely not a Star Trek tourist. I am a fan, but I think, Mike, you're probably the biggest fan of the three of us in this pod right now.
Yeah, but even then, I would not even characterize myself as like a huge fan, you know?
Sure.
So it's weird, but yeah, go on.
Yeah, so I'm definitely like familiar. Like, I've watched all of TOS, I've watched all of Next Generation, and I really enjoy it for a lot of the reasons you were saying, Mike. Like, sci-fi is probably like my favorite genre, definitely for literature, and then I mean it's up there for film, just because it does allegory better than, well, in my opinion at least, than like so many other genres. Like, I feel like when I watch horror movies nowadays, every allegory is just like, this is an allegory for generational trauma, and that's like always the allegory. But there's so many different like socio-political things that can be touched on in a way when you have like a sci-fi environment, and Star Trek has been doing that so well for such a long time. Like, one of my all-time favorite episodes of television ever is Balance of Terror in Star Trek, which is where they first meet the Romulans, who look just like Vulcans. And so you get this allegory for, like, I mean, it feels a lot like when FDR put all of the Japanese Americans into internment camps because they look like the bad guy, and people are starting to treat Spock like that because he looks like the bad guy. And then, you know, we also saw some of that with 9/11. So anyway, it's just like they do such a good job of touching on different socio-political issues and allegorizing them, and this was not an exception to that. I thought it was great. I thought the CGI was actually really good for 91, mm-hmm. unless there's just like yeah. a remastered version. Is that what it looked like originally?
No, I think that's how it looked originally. That like, the model great. Work is actually really good.
The model yeah. work is yeah. dope. No, it was model work is super cool.
So it yeah. looked really good. I agree, MJ. The pacing was really good. Just good storytelling. William Shatner's acting is better than it was in TOS. you know what?
He's good in this movie. I think he's good in it.
Yeah.
He is, and as much as it should on paper be the hokiest, stupidest thing in the world, give me all of Christopher Plummer as the Shakespeare quoting Klingon pirate. That was my favorite thing in the whole world. Even when he's still quoting it like relentlessly and in rapid fire at the end, it's so ridiculous. Like, shut the hell up. It was so good. Yeah. So yeah, I had so much fun with it. It was yeah, good pick. I like it.
Yeah, I think that speaking of William Shatner's acting, I think Nicholas Meyer always knew how to get the best out of the mm-hmm. actors, because he did a good job getting William Shatner to emote and act in Wrath mm-hmm. of Khan. Sure. Also,
yeah.
I think I read some anecdote basically that Nicholas Meyer like just had William Shatner go through like a bajillion takes, so that by like the 20th take, he's just like. Exhausted all the showy dramatic
all the Shatner-y stuff.
Yes. and so like, and then it's just like pure performance then, and you know, I don't know if that was like what it was like with this movie, but whatever it is, he managed to get the best out of I think like a lot of the cast.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, no, it's great. I really can't believe this movie works, because yeah. it changes genres so many times.
Like, yeah.
It's yeah, like, it's very masterful actually,
but it feels yeah, smooth. It smoothly flows through all of them. I'm like, okay, I'm with
yeah.
it.
Yeah, okay, we're doing a courtroom drama.
Yeah,
sure,
why not?
Of course. Why wouldn't the Klingons have a human judicial model?
Yes.
Like, what? And I also
he doesn't use a gavel, though. He uses, like, this electric, like ball thing.
Yeah, to go. with a claw glove.
I love it.
And, like, it was just also ridiculous that Chang is also the friggin' prosecuting attorney yep. for the Klingon the yep. Klingon court as well. Like, that's his side hustle.
Oh, so
that really
much.
Made me laugh.
He was so good. I love Christopher
yeah,
Plummer in this.
He was great in this movie. He was so ridiculous.
Oh man.
Yeah,
but yeah, like it that shit that. Shouldn't work.
No.
And yeah. then it does.
It's so weird, but it's so perfect.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Yeah, I guess I was reading about the movie, and I guess Roddenberry like really didn't like a lot of it.
Yeah.
Oh no.
Like the script. And I think it's because it depicts the crew of the Enterprise as like being bigoted, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and he was like, that's not what I did with these, like that's not what I wanted with these characters. And Nicholas Meyer was like, why do you think bigotry would go away all of a sudden?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, like, so I guess my understanding is like the first couple of seasons of The Next Generation, that's like when Roddenberry also had like a heavy hand over it, and he had a directive, was like, there's no conflict, right? Like everyone like gets along in the future and it's utopia. And like, the writers are like, well, how do we like write stories then?
Yeah.
And I think this movie also, he was trying to go and exert that influence. But by that point, he was obviously really sick and ill, and his like influence was waning, and the mm-hmm. Next Generation, which had already been a couple years into its filming at this point, like had shifted away from that philosophy too. And they realized that like, hey, you know, to make compelling stories, you need to kind of have some drama,
right.
and some conflict between characters, and have them like learn something, have character arcs. They can't just be fucking perfect.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's not going to make a good story. So, you know, I think, yeah, there were some reservations about that. I don't even think William Shatner like liked some of the prejudice that his character is expressing. That was my mm-hmm. understanding, but
it's so necessary.
I think it worked for the benefit of the film. Yeah,
yeah, it's just
exactly.
it's a real part
to tell the
part...
story that it needs to.
No, exactly. Well, because that's it's whether it's Cold War or not, just that idea of having to like kind of relinquish feelings, however strong they've been for that you've had for such a long time. Like you said, like that doesn't go away overnight, and that's. You know, I mean, yes, it happened to be like bigoted towards a race in this movie, but that's, I mean, that's a good thing to explore. That's huge growth and a great arc for a character to have to go through, because that's tough, and we yeah. all have to do it at some point, kind of let go of things you've been holding on to.
right? And I guess to lay the table a little bit for the audience who hasn't seen it, you know, it's obviously that the crew of the Enterprise doesn't like the Klingons or their empire because of stuff in the TV shows, but it doesn't really matter like what it entails. And then obviously in one of the movies, Kirk's son got killed by a Klingon, so he has like a personal grudge against them. And so they're asked to go and help with this peace process because the Klingon Empire is dying, kind of similar to how the Soviet Union was collapsing. And so they are obviously against being a part of this. They would rather have some other crew go and do this instead. So that is like the genesis of like the political conflict, I guess, of the movie. And then the funny thing is that, you know, this movie goes and shows there's an even more extremist group of people who like really don't like this idea of this war settling. And it forces them to go and confront their own, you know, bigotry and their own extremism by meeting an even more extremist faction that like really wants to nix the peace process, which I think is really interesting, like, concept, right? Is that they're like they're being confronted with like the worst version of themselves, essentially.
Well, and the thing is, like, the it's done so well because even the extremist group, it's like it is bigotry, but it doesn't feel like it because it's portrayed like you see their thought process of just wanting to like preemptively defend themselves, like we need peace, like, but this is not going to be the way because, you know, we can't trust them. So it's, I mean, I guess, yeah, that's still bigotry, but it's like, I don't know, it's more understandable. Like, you can see where everyone's coming from and just, like, we are scared because we've been tricked by these people before, so we're scared to trust them now. And which is good, because I don't like having just, like, a black and white villain, although Chang is pretty close to it.
The actual, like, villain himself is very, like, black and white, but, like, the issues that they're dealing with are a little more nuanced. I mean, you know, if we'd been at war with like a country for 50 years or however long that they were in this story, you know, you would probably have some suspicions about that country, you know, as well by the end of that process. So, you know, I think that that's like a really interesting lens for the story. But then it's also like a lot of other things too. There's the idea that there's like a murder mystery aspect to it, you know, which is which also fits in with the Cold War thriller. Which, once again, now looking back, I'm like, now I see why I like all these like things. And maybe like when I was 3 and a half, I even picked up on it a little bit. I don't know. But, you know, there's like this aspect of who went and killed the chancellor or whatever and the investigation into that. And it manages like these genre shifts like that very well, honestly. Because the movie could fall apart very easily. And yet it seems to be aware of its tone and like what to do at any given point, which is great.
There's only one moment where I saw the seams on it where it was like after the dinner and like the two guys are being like, openly racist, like saying shit that like you hear racists say where they're like, oh, the smell, or what do they say, like,
oh yeah,
the language. And I was just like, yeah, I get it, like, you don't need to be that
nose.
It's super on the nose. It was just like, yeah, man, they're racist, like, I get it, like, that was the only part where I was like, this movie thinks I'm stupid about that part, like, it's so obvious. But that was it, where it was just like, that was the only part where I was like, I don't need that in there. It's just, you're really using a sledgehammer on me, guys, like, pump the brakes. But that's the only like edit about the social commentary that I would have made. I did think it was wild to have Kirk invite them over and then call them Hitler.
Nowadays, we're like, I feel like Hitler and fascist is like thrown around so frequently, but I'm like, do Klingons even know who that is? I'm like, so
they know who Shakespeare is.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
They really know who Shakespeare is.
They read him in the original Klingon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh gosh.
Yeah. Actually, now that feels like that's thrown around even more today than it was back then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, it goes and shifts into a different mode then when it's going to get into the Cold War, like, aspect of it. And, you know, there's kind of like this, like, Manchurian Candidate, Day of the Condor, I don't know, like, whatever kind of feel to, like, this stuff, right?
Those Pakula movies, yeah, right? Like, yes. President's Men, Parallax View, Three Days of the Condor, yeah.
Yeah, right. And so then it becomes about, like, you know, who's doing this? What's, like, the point of the conspiracy? I've seen this movie now a couple times, so, I mean, was it a shock for you guys, like, who it ends up being, or is it pretty obvious now?
No. No. I was like, new person, yeah. You're bad.
Right, Kim Cattrall,
don't trust you.
Yeah. Very obviously Kim Cattrall.
Like, the thing is, like, I didn't care. Like, sometimes I'm annoyed by it, but this, like, I don't know, everything was so good, and it... I feel like if I can tell who it is right away, at least give me a good story leading up to it and let everything fall into place where it needs to, so that it's, you know, when the reveal happens, it's, you know, earned. And it was. It wasn't this. So I thought it was, you know, well done.
Yeah, I think mean, it's less about the surprise of it and more just like the reasons for it.
Yes,
and
yes.
And like it making sense, because it's like these characters don't want things to change for whatever reason, right? You know, and so so it's not about being a surprise, I guess, in a way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, and you know, it took me until she vaporized the pot to put two and two together. But she did that, and I was like, oh, duh. Like, it just, like, it all made sense at that moment. And that is before they technically reveal that it's her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But she did that, and I was like, oh, yeah, you are trying real hard, lady. And so I guess it was, like, effective with me in that moment. But, yeah, it ultimately doesn't matter. Her motivations are what matter more. And then I like Spock being the foil to her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I love Spock.
Spock's great, because I really like especially by this era of Star Trek, they've really figured out the half human, half Vulcan Spock.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really do a great job with, like, him find, like, not only has he found the balance in that, the writers have as well.
Yes.
And so he gets to, like, be really, like, sage and poignant and, like, hit the balance between logic and, you know, human emotion, which is really neat. Like, the scene where he's just, like, vibing in his robe. and Kirk. Yeah. When Kirk comes and talks to him, and he's just, like, staring at the ceiling.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, you know, have we become so old and inflexible that we've, like, essentially made ourselves outdated? And it was just like, whoa, that is introspective as hell, homie.
And that's something else, right? Like, beyond just all the Cold War stuff, this movie's dealing with, like, the idea of legacy and the fact that, you know, this older generation of actors now is kind of, like, in the twilight of their careers, and this movie,
which is what Wrath of Khan was dealing about.
It's
10 years later.
Right. It's funny. Like, there's something pretty crazy about this idea that, you know, these guys that are in some show, like this TV show that was kind of chintzy in the 60s, right? And here they are in 1991, like, making movies off of it still. And, you know, it had this, like, impact. And now, like, they've inhabited these characters for so long that's, like, they, like, fit them with, like, a glove. You know what I mean? I think, like, Nimoy especially. Shatner, obviously, too. It's just, like, man, they are just, like, so comfortable in those characters' skins. And while despite, I guess, you know, behind the scenes kind of grappling with the fact that this was going to be their legacy for a while there. But I just think it's, like, a testament to, like, all these people kind of being masters of their craft and having time to go and hone their craft and, like, their familiarity with these characters in a way that you kind of don't see that often. I mean, I guess you could have the counter argument be all the Marvel movies had these people be the characters for 20 movies, but that was, like, a more compacted period of time than this.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the only other amalgam, but the last two movies with him weren't good, is Harrison Ford and Indiana Jones, right?
True, where
it should feel that way, and then it doesn't, because he doesn't give a shit anymore. You know, and I guess, like, some of the Star Wars Legacy character stuff, too, a little bit should feel that way. And, like, but, I mean, even by the time, you know, we get around to the Kelvin timeline and we see Nimoy show up, he's good, because he can't I don't think he can be bad as that character, but, like, I don't know. It just, like, it doesn't feel the same as like this.
Mm. Right. Seeing them like in their element with each other is, mm-hmm. is kind of important. And it, obviously, you know, even the director slash writer of this had some familiarity. He was part of the other movies. Like,
right.
you know, there's something about mm-hmm. like the people who made this thing were all working together still and not just like bits and pieces of it shoved somewhere else in some other thing. Yeah. So, I mean, I really respect that. And it's crazy, like, that some big movie, like, has a bunch of, like, you know, what, 56-year-olds, like,
right. yeah,
and, like, in the lead roles, like, you know, there's, like, 7 or 8 of them. Like, that, I mean, that's yeah. freaking unheard of.
Yeah.
Especially in, like, a big budget, you know, for that time movie.
Yeah.
It's kind of impressive.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Shatner's 60 in this movie, right?
Wow. Like, yeah.
I also feel like a difference between, like, the Marvel stuff. Like you were saying, and this is like, of course there's a cash grab element to continuing to make sequels of like an IP, but this doesn't mm-hmm. feel like it. Like, it just feels like, I mean, Leonard Nimoy helped with the story, right? It just feels like they had a good idea mm-hmm. for a story and they're like, let's make a fucking film because we're still making Star Trek films, like, rather than just seeming like we want more money for our studio. And it, I don't know, it just felt a little more heartfelt, I guess.
Yeah, well, and it also, because it feels like it has something to say, which yeah. is, you know,
yes.
like going back a bajillion times, the conversation we've had, but for people who haven't heard this, me articulate this before, a lot of the Marvel movies were kind of about nothing. Mm-hmm. Like, they really
right.
didn't have, that was like my big knock against them.
Yeah. Which is wild, because, you know, comics are so also allegorical.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And yeah, exactly. Like, they were used to go and explore issues like, obviously, the X-Men and mm-hmm. things like that.
Civil
right?
rights and stuff. Yeah. yeah.
So, right. And so, you know, and then they decided generally not to be about anything. And the only one that kind of felt like it was actually going towards saying something was the other Cold War analogy.
Or Winter Soldier.
Winter Soldier one, which is the only like really good one, in my opinion. And so it's kind of funny how there's a connection between all that, because
I think, you know, the Guardians movies generally want to be about something larger.
Yeah, yeah. I think like, especially about like the characters themselves, mm-hmm. like yeah. trying to say something about them.
Well, two. So, I think two has a lot to say about grief and yeah, drama and family and like family. What that means and
right.
what and it means, like, especially when your family is like broken or like abusive. Like,
yeah, right. Yeah, like not like Fast and Furious family,
right?
Like genericness, but like something that actually talks about like who your real father is. If mm-hmm. you know, he's a piece of shit. Like the one, your bio father is.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Know? Like, how do you reconcile that? And then. Fine, like yeah. one, not repeat the same mistakes even though you feel a little destined to because that's your bloodline
mm-hmm.
and right. yeah, like, I think there's something on that movie's mind. I think there's something on Black Panther's mind as well, but those are like the only yeah.
but the fact that that's yeah, yeah. two or three out of like 28, it's like no.
yeah
yeah right yeah, yeah. I could think of probably, I think you probably named every single one of them.
Yeah. The first third of Endgame has a lot to say about grief and like how it manifests physically in ourselves, but that's that's about it.
yeah. Yeah. And so that's the reason why I picked this, because, you know, if you're going to spend, I think it was like $30 million to make this movie or whatever, mm-hmm. like, if you're going to spend $100 million to make a movie, like, can you at least try to make it say something?
Right.
You know, I realize there's like an impulse with a blockbuster to, you spent that much money, you don't want to alienate or piss off anyone, so you want to make it not say anything.
Mm-hmm.
But my argument is that you spend that kind of money on something, like, I feel like it should be meaningful. It should have some soul to it. And not just be, you know, a bunch of action figures bashing each other. That's great.
Right.
And that has its place. But man, I just feel like, you know, you can do both too. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah,
you know, they're like, there's not like a ton of action in this movie, but it's pretty fun. Like, I feel like at the end, you know,
yeah,
there's like, you know, like a neat little kind of like battle of wits going on, not to the degree of maybe some of the other like best Star Trek, you know, naval battle type things, but mm-hmm. you know, it's entertaining enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, you know, you can have your cake and eat it too, is my take on it.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, there's a couple, because even like the beginning, right? Like, it's the Klingon energy planet energy.
Yeah.
Like, it's Chernobyl,
yeah.
right? Like,
right. Yep.
from the outset, it's just like they did a Chernobyl and now they're dying. So like, let's figure that, like, let's help them, because one of the you know, reasons Starfleet is because we need to protect people who need help.
Mm-hmm.
And then it like, yeah, there's suspicion there despite the olive branch nature of that act.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, there's like a lot of things that are just straight up lifted from like, you know, Cold War stuff, just like the part where Kirk's on trial and then Chang Sung, I'm like, don't wait for the translation, answer the question, is like straight from like the Cuban Missile Crisis, when like they're having debates in the UN about this. Is like, that's like a line that was used then when they were fighting over it, like when the US was accusing Russia of stuff, it would, like, our ambassador said, like, to don't wait for the translation, you know what we said, kind of thing. So, like, you know, there's just, like, all this stuff is just ripe history. Human experience is, like, ripe to go and, like, you know, be iterated on and talked about and examined through, like, a different lens. So that's kind of, like, why it's important to me, because, you know, that kind of stuff inspires me to kind of tell stories that, you know, can be both entertaining to, like, a bigger audience, but also, you know, still maybe have something to say. And it's not like what this thing is saying is that controversial. It's like, give peace a chance. Like, man, if you get pissed off by that, then you've got some problems.
You're right. Yeah. Hey, what if we tried to talk this shit out sometimes?
Yeah.
No. MJ, I have a question for you since you're a Star Trek tourist.
Yeah.
So I know for me, like, so I didn't know Kirk had a son. When I saw the picture, I was like, oh, okay, I'm assuming that's from a movie that I haven't seen. Did you feel, I mean, I know you've dabbled in it. Did you feel up to speed enough with everything that they gave you? Or did you, were you at all like, what is going on? Or I'm confused by anything?
So what I will say is I watched this with my friend Josh, who is a massive Star Trek fan.
Oh, okay.
I texted him and his wife, April, who are like two of my really good friends out here. Josh, I know you're listening. Hi, buddy. And I was like, yo, we got a bunch of food left over from the brunch we did today. Also, I got to watch Star Trek VI. You guys want to come over? And Josh was like, yeah. Like, that's that's how you summon Josh. And so he kept me up to speed if I had any questions, but I only had like two.
Okay.
Maybe even one.
Yeah.
It was, my one question was, had Klingons appeared in the original series at this point?
Yes.
And I had assumed as much, but I wasn't 100% sure. And then when I saw the picture of his son, I was like, oh, he must have a son that died because of Klingons.
Right.
And he was like, I have a son that died because of Klingons. Yeah. And I was like, yeah. Like, I've seen enough movies to know that that was what was going to happen. But yeah, it was not different. Like, the only thing I was maybe a little confused on was Sulu being a captain.
Right.
But I didn't really ask a question about it or look it up. So it didn't matter. I was just like, oh, okay, he got his own ship. Cool.
Yeah, because I was thinking about that when I was watching it, like when I saw Kirk's son and stuff. And normally, I know I can be a bitch about like exposition and how it's delivered. I feel like there was enough delivered that if you're not super familiar with the series or the other movies, you are not totally lost. Like, if you know it all, you can enjoy it more to a more fuller extent. But if you don't, it's still like, okay, I get, like you said, this is movie 101. I get what's happening. There's a picture of the dead son and, you know, the Klingons are, you know, responsible for it. Okay. So it's good. I was just curious because I was like, they actually do that really, really well, considering that's the sixth movie after an entire series, to be able to hop in. And I would argue, I want to find somebody who's not a Star Trek fan and have them watch it. I feel like they could keep up with it pretty well, given what they're given in the movie.
I tend to think Star Trek does that pretty well, just in general. Mm-hmm. Like, as long as you know who the characters are, it's pretty good. Because, like, I watched Strange New Worlds season one, and I didn't feel really lost by that at all. I needed a little bit of backstory of, like, what Pike was doing there. But that was it. Like, I was able to follow it pretty okay. And then also, like, the only, like, but I've seen Wrath of Khan, and I know the, like, base plot of the movies between this and that. And so the only thing I could see that would be really confusing is Spock going, I've been dead before. Because that would sound like some real up his own ass pretentious shit to say if you didn't know he had literally died in number two and came back in three.
Right. Yeah. I think like that's something else that is impressive about this, was what you're saying, Missy, is that, you know, you could jump into the really good ones, like the good Star Trek movies, and not feel lost. But I mean, this is also just a function of this is how like the TV shows worked too, right? I mean, they mostly they have like a continuity, yes, but like, you know, generally every episode was standalone, and that's kind of how they treat the movies. You know, there's like a branch of movies like 2, 3, and 4 that kind of like really kind of lead into each other of the original series movies, but like you can still jump into them and kind of get what's going on generally.
Wales.
Yeah, right. You know, the TV show is that same way. It's like you can watch a lot of episodes out of order and you'll be fine. And this is like a skill or an ability that's been lost over time.
Yes, 100%.
Because, you know, like it gets to one of my other pet peeves, right? Which is like all these streaming shows are all a bunch of serials that take like one plot and they spread it across 10 episodes. Mm-hmm. And that plot could barely sustain a movie, let alone 10 hours of television. When you have that one serial plot and it sucks and you have 10 episodes that suck instead of maybe you have one episode that sucks in an episodic show, but then the next episode's a banger. You know, it's the same thing with these movies, right? People can have this meme of all the even numbers Star Trek movies are good and the odd numbers are bad, and it means that you don't have to watch the odd numbered ones
and you're not because
like
anything.
They don't feed into each other. You know, like there's something good about that. Like, that's the reason why, like, a lot of these franchises and stuff have gotten off track, because they're so interdependent on each other that one being bad ended up derailing the whole damn thing.
Yeah.
Because now I can't watch the new Star Wars stuff because I haven't watched, like, the other 5 Star Wars things. It's like, they're so dependent on each other.
Especially the bad ones.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, Marvel's becoming increasingly that.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and then, like, you know, even the attempts at it are still serialized. Like, might cover your ears. I'm going to talk about Rian Johnson, but
yeah, go ahead.
Like, he did that show on Peacock, Poker Face, with Natasha Lyonne or whatever.
I haven't watched
that. Because it was like a Columbo thing, right? Like, it was like, oh, she's like a good amateur detective, and like she can read people really well. And I thought it was okay. It was okay enough for me to want to watch a second episode, except they serialized it. And I was like, no, that's not what Columbo is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's why Columbo's so great.
Yeah, exactly. And so what I'm told is that it doesn't come back again, and like the reason why she's traveling the country doesn't come back around until the last episode. But I was like, I still don't want that. I just need her just solving you know. And he is doing that with the Knives Out movies, so like Glass Onion doesn't tie back into Knives Out, so you can jump into those, but that's about it. Like, it's the most recent example I can find, and it's just 2 movies, so like that's not really a commitment. You know what I mean? I was so pissed because I was like, well, I like Knives Out a lot, and I didn't like Glass Onion, but I like Knives Out enough to like give this another shot with him and this medium. Like, I think it's neat. And then it was just like, it completely took me out of it that like they had a backstory that they were going to pursue as a through line through these. I was just like, no, I don't want that out of this. This is not what I came here for.
They think about like how bad and like loaded all the Daniel Craig, James Bond movies got with like the trying to tie all these things together. When if they had just cut loose and just told episodic stories, it probably would have been better. Like, I mean, the I was the author of all your pain Blofeld crap, right? Just really derailed this whole thing. Not everything needs to be a mythology. Obviously, this movie that we're talking about, like, there's a mythology, right? There's stuff about Klingons, you know, there's different races and empires and all this kind of stuff, species. But it's written in a way that it's accessible still. You know, I know Star Trek has a... I know that, like, you know, Star Trek has a reputation for being full of just, like, you know, the worst nerds ever. But, like, it's still written in a pretty accessible way that anybody can jump into, like, any given episode or movie and enjoy it. And I think that is a skill or a trait that's been lost. You know, some of these series are getting so impenetrable to be able to watch it. And then you get told, like, oh, like, just bear with, like, the first season or two, and then it gets
fuck
good.
That.
It's like, what the hell, guys?
There's no way. And like, it's very rare. That is there even anything on TV that's episodic right now?
besides like, you know, some crime show, you know,
crime and sci-fi are the only things that can do it. Because when you were talking about movies, I was like, oh, the Poirot ones are, you know, serialized as well. But that's, I think, like, murder mystery and sci-fi lend themselves best to episodic.
Yeah, that's a good...
Because Black Mirror one also... Anthology.
Oh, Black Mirror is episodic.
That's like an anthology, again, sci-fi, right? You know, like, that's like different characters every episode.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Versus, like, something that has, like, the same characters, but they're dealing with, like, a new situation.
Oh, is the Orville serialized?
No. It was very much, like, episodic, like, Star Trek. Like, old OG Star Trek.
Yeah,
which
is
why it was good.
Right. The Poirot movies, I will say, they are serialized, but I only saw the Haunting in Venice one, and I was fine.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't matter.
All you need to know is he's a detective, and that's pretty much it. And he's good at what he does.
Yeah. And I liked that movie a lot, so.
I did, too. And I thought the first one was actually kind of bad.
I didn't have any interest in the first two, which is why I never saw them. And then I heard really good things about the third one. So I was like, okay, yeah, I'll watch this. And then I was like, oh, this is great. I thought it was awesome. I didn't feel like I missed anything by not seeing the first two.
Right.
Yeah. And that to me is just like way more preferable, especially when you go and then go and have a sci-fi series where it's like, they can have the world building to, they set up these different cultures and things like that, and they can have them stand in for, you know, real world problems and stuff like that. That's like such like a cool like storytelling tool to have. And we're getting so far away from that.
I mean, I guess Strange New World sort of did it in the parts I saw. I only watched like half the first season. There wasn't too much serialization happening in it.
I've only seen a little bit too. It wasn't really to my like taste, although it was getting closer to kind of how I think these shows should be,
right?
But yeah, it was more like episodic, it seemed like.
Because I watched the first, I think, half of the season, and I, like, there was, I guess, a mild connection of like what happened to whatever, the ship that disappeared or whatever, but they didn't really dedicate any episode time to it aside from being like, that thing disappeared. Which I guess like is the exact same thing I was saying about Poker Face. Like, everyone I talked about was like, yeah, it's not really a thing. It's just a reason to get her out of Vegas. But then it comes back in the last episode. And I was like, I don't.
But you know what? Your Columbo show should just be standalone. I'm sorry.
Because like, what? I don't know shit about Columbo as a character. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know anything about that guy.
And I don't care.
All you know is he's married. He has a wife that he periodically talks about, but you never meet. And you don't need to, and you don't want to. You just want to know him. And that's it.
Yeah, exactly.
Watch him solve mysteries.
Yeah, the only characterization that Columbo has is he asks a lot of questions and he's a wife guy.
Like, one more thing.
And you don't even know if the stuff about his wife is true or not.
It might not be
right. Glorious.
he might just be trying to find stuff out.
Yeah.
Columbo's, you know, so good. I mean, I saw sometimes when I like spend time with my parents, they're watching like Law and Order, like Criminal Intent or something like that, right? And it's like the Vincent D'Onofrio like seasons, and like I guess like they're kind of like sprinkling in some stuff more about his personal life or his home life or whatever. And it's like, you know, like I find that temptation to do that for some of these things, like, kind of bad, actually.
Yeah, no, it is. Sometimes you just need him to be like, I'm good at solving crimes.
Yeah, like, and that's something else that's like kind of nice about Star Trek. I mean, I know that they have like their personal bigotries and stuff like that in this movie, but generally they're still professionals who like set aside that stuff and are trying to do their jobs the best way that they can. The same way like some detective on like a good crime show is just trying to do his job. Like, there's something like that I like about staying in your lane, like when it comes to like a certain genre or you're telling a story. And you know, if you want to tell a story about like a troubled detective or whatever who's got a bad personal life, like, then do that kind of from the start. But like the weird like sprinkling in or like destroying kind of like the original intent of things, that's where it gets me. And so anyway, that's a big giant detour in this thing, but it's kind of one thing I've been thinking about a lot lately, which is the reason why I chose it as my movie.
I will also say,
yeah.
One thing that I really liked about it is that we've had a huge step up in our practical animals being used as alien monsters, going from the Cocker Spaniel with a horn on its head that was in the original series to this monster, the thing that was clearly a dog with like some weird face thing put on it in the prison. I was like, oh, it's still a dog, but at least it looks better than the Cocker Spaniel with a horn on its head.
Yeah.
So good job, Star Trek. Yeah,
I will say, I think the prison segment's kind of like the worst segment of the movie.
It's not great.
It's like, what?
It's kind of like shitty Star Wars cantina scene.
Yes, it is. That's exactly the vibe I got.
But it was still fun.
Yeah, it's fun. You know, it's like the most out of place.
It's the dumbest part,
but
yeah, it's fun.
Yeah.
There's a really cool shot when Kirk and Bones are talking in bed, and Bones gets up and like he like flips which side of the bed his head's on, and as he does that the camera like spins around the head of the bed to the side view, and I thought that was really cool. That was my favorite shot on the movie, probably.
Nice.
Yeah.
I thought that conversation
itself was good.
That scene is really good. But yeah, the like it's just so Star Wars and it just doesn't fit. Like, and it also kind of reminds me of Guardians 1 when they go to the prison. Like, I was like, oh shit, he stole this directly from Star Trek 6.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's not my favorite scene. I mean, I almost don't like any prison scene in any movie. Like, that part in Guardians 1, not a huge fan of it. I don't know why. It's like a thing against prison movies, I guess. But, like, the stuff leading up to it, I mean, I realize that the trial stuff, obviously, attorney.
Sure.
But actually, I've been to, like, some conferences about, like, how to interview witnesses and things like that. And one of the lecturers, who I'm assuming is, you know, a Trekkie or something like that, goes and plays that scene, actually. Because it actually really is, like, kind of good about, like, how to use evidence, how to, like, do direct examination, cross-examination. Like, it actually is, like, not that bad or inaccurate, like, or offensive, like, to, like a lawyer's sensibilities, which is saying something. Because, like, you know, we're always, like, super critical of, like, oh, it would never work like that, you know?
Well, Mike, I had a hang up with that scene because no one suggested anybody buy American.
Man, I love the deep cut reference there.
Thanks. I like that scene when it went from they have to use a translator to like everyone's just speaking English now. Like, I like it when a movie takes a shortcut like that, where it's like, hey, you get it. We're doing this now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes. Yeah, right. Exactly. Like, it established, like, cause that way you're not asking, like, where are they doing the trial in English when they're all Klingons, you know, blah, blah. But it did it, like, super effectively in 5 seconds.
Yeah.
Just a hard cut. And I was like, dope. Thank you. Like, thank you for letting me put two and two together here.
Yeah. But I like the staging of it. You know, you could tell this movie didn't
have,
like,
the set is cool.
Yeah. They didn't have the biggest budget to make, like, the biggest set. So they, like, did things that were smart. You know, they made it intimidating in a different way. It's like, it's really tall imposing, you know?
I was reading that they filmed this on sets that they were filming Next Gen.
TNG,
And then, like, some other sets, like, couldn't be used, so they had to go and find, like, places out of the studio to go and film. Like, the conference, for example, is filmed at, like, a Presbyterian church at the end of the movie.
That's really funny.
Yeah, because like, you can kind of basically see the pews, essentially. They made, like, smart decisions. Because, Paramount didn't want to spend a lot of money on this. But, like, it's kind of like,
Five
again,
didn't do well.
Right, yeah. The last movie had been a big bomb. And they were thinking about maybe even doing, like, a prequel series that didn't even star the original, like, cast and stuff. So this is kind of like their last rodeo. But, you know, like, obviously, I think this goes and shows that sometimes having constraints, budget-wise, all that kind of stuff, actually breeds, like, good creative decisions.
Oh, yeah,
because 100%. You know, sometimes I think, like, having unfettered access to CG and money has made these movies so bloated. And that's why we have these 2-hour, 45-minute movies, because it actually is more economical to go and spend, like, if you're going to spend $200 million to make, like, a 2-hour movie, you might as well just spend $250 million to make a 3-hour movie. Then people feel like they've gotten their value for it.
Right.
Or whatever. Versus this, like, you know, they're trying to penny pinch, and so they're making smart decisions, and it makes the story lean.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
MJ, I'm sure you were looking at, like, when trying to research this, like, they had, like, a big opening scene where it's, like, everyone's kind of, like, on the verge of retirement, and it's, like, everyone's kind of getting recruited or something like that.
Yeah,
like,
getting the team back together sequence.
Right. Mm. But you know what? Like, they cut all that out because it would have been too expensive to go and film, like, in this location and that and doing this thing. But you know what? Like, this kind of got right to the freaking point.
Yeah. Yeah, like, you just jump in. You just jump into it.
And the movie's, like, so much better, I think, kind of for it, actually.
Yeah. The other thing I read, filmed from March to September 1991, released December 1991.
Wow.
Crazy. Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah.
And there's, like, not, like, an insignificant amount of, like, you know, model work and stuff like that they had to go and do still.
Yeah.
But, I mean, just it goes and shows how, like, bloated, like, movie making has become, I think, in so many ways.
Well, we talked about that a little bit in Network because Corey had brought up that scene with Ned Beatty, how, like, they were constrained by the lighting that they could use. And that ended up being so effective just because they had to kind of be creative and adapt to what they had. It's, let's do that with more.
Yeah.
Let's take away more of the budgets and make people have to be creative again in filmmaking.
Yeah.
Yeah. You, when you guys were talking about that in Network, I was thinking back because I listened to the podcast. I wasn't part of it, but I went and looked up the scene on YouTube like before I'd even listened to the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking like that was a really interesting choice that like they had Ned Beatty go and walk like in total darkness
for
like half that monologue. Uh-huh. And then it made sense. But, like, I actually think it was, like, just a good decision in general. Like, you know, it was because, like, he's, like, moving away from the light, like, into the darkness to, like, tell this lie, like you know, as the devil, essentially.
Yeah.
And it was so good. I love the fact that, like, these kind of things happen and then people have to work with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and just to get, like, super personal. Sorry I interrupted you, MJ.
No, you're good.
You know, we've all made movies together, right? Obviously, we don't have big budgets when we do them. And sometimes, like, it's not how it was written on paper or how, like, we envisioned it when we arrived. But, like, having to think of creatively about stuff sometimes, like, births, like, such, like, incredible, like, creativity and, like, makes things better as a result of it.
No, I often brush up against, like, the limitations of the point. Like, if I'm banging my head against something... And it's like, I need to find a workaround for it. Like, I get weird. You know what I mean? Or I'll take a step back and, like, go do something else. And, like, feed, like, I call it, like, well, Josh Ritter, my favorite musical artist of all time, calls it, like, feeding the monster, where it's just like, I don't know, go see something that you want to go see. Go watch a movie you want to go see. Go listen to a record you want to go see. Go see a band. Like, go take something else in. Step away from it for a second. You hit the limit, right? The limit is there. Go seek something else out and then come back to it and see what your workaround is after you do that. I think that's really good advice for, like, creating something where it's just like, stop banging your head against the wall. Like, don't worry about writer's block. Like, before you fire up ChatGPT, like, explore every fucking avenue and just, like, make sure you have no other options, you know? Because the thing that you come up with might be too convenient or lazy or, like, noticeably amateurish. Like, I don't know. There's so many movies that just feel like they were like, well, what if we did this, right? Like,
right. Just throw money at it.
If we just throw money at it, or if we just do, like, I just watched Late Night with the Devil, which was one of my most anticipated movies of the year, and I didn't, like, the further I get from it, the less I like it, because there's, the main reason is there's this really fucking lazy exposition dump at the beginning of the movie. It's like, it's like a solid 6 minutes of just,
Of
just like,
oh, I liked it, but I know it's, I get why you wouldn't,
of giving you the backstory of, like, this late night host and his wife that died, but he's also a member of the Bohemian Grove and he's a rival of Carson and he's desperate for ratings, and it's like the first 5 years of this dude's career just told to you with a bunch of, like, poorly photoshopped pictures of him on magazine covers. And yeah, they got Michael Ironside to do it, so it sounds cool because it's Sam Fisher. But, like, I was so bored of that by the end of that sequence that I was like, I don't, just let me figure all this stuff out from the movie. Like, just make the movie and let me, like, put two and two together. Don't just hold my hand through it because you got confused on your page.
right? I'm trying to think, like, in terms of exposition, right? There's a good way to do it, and there's like a bad way to do it. Did you guys, we talked about this before, have you guys seen the most recent Mission Impossible movie?
No.
Okay, so there's like a segment in the first 5 to 10 minutes of it where they go into like this whole thing, like there's like this boardroom kind of meeting where people are talking about like the AI or whatever that's like the bad guy of the film, and also it just keeps going and going and going. And I was sitting there watching it with my family, and like some of my family started fucking laughing, like because like everyone's like finishing each other's sentences, right? And like talking in a really unnatural way, like to just like split up this long monologue that clearly, like, you know, they just decided, okay, this actor does this portion of it and this actor does another portion of it, and it's so awkward and uncomfortable, and it keeps going, and like you think it's over and then it continues some more. And I go and think about how, like, man, you can do that really poorly. Or then this movie, like, there's an exposition dump. It's like they say, oh, the Klingon Empire's got 50 years left to live. But it's done in, like, a really compelling way.
I agree.
I think. Godzilla Minus One does the same thing, right? Does almost this exact same scene.
Yeah, exactly. They lay out the threat, and then characters, like, interject, and they infect it with their personality and their spin on things, which makes it feel like, which makes it less obvious than that it's just some monologue that's been broken up between people. It's actually like opposing viewpoints debating something. And that's why I like, I mean, this movie is primarily just people talking, but it's staged in ways that are compelling. And, you know, there's like, the characters, you kind of know where they're coming from. Like, Kirk is always going to respond like in this way. Spock's going to respond in this way. And so they have a point of view, which is interesting. And you see those clash, you know, and Kirk and Spock like feel a little hurt. I mean, Kirk especially, by each other, you know, and their decision making, and that's compelling. That's what makes like a talking scene interesting. It's not just two people parroting what the other person says.
Yeah, I think it also, in thinking about that and what you're saying with the exposition and how is Kirk gonna respond, how Spock gonna respond, it helps so much that they're so well established, like we talked about, in their characters, that you don't have to put in the unnecessary exposition of, ah, Spock, my friend for this many years, who we have been through this together with, like Dune does. It's just like, you know, because they know their characters so well inside out, that immediately as soon as they start interacting, it allows the audience to, even if they're not familiar with the show, it trusts them a little bit to have to be smart to understand the relationship, which you can pick up on because they're so good at it. And it also is not just like spoon feeding you and hand holding the whole time, trying to make sure that you know who everybody is, which is great.
Yeah. Yeah, and that comes down to the acting. Just like the world wariness that they carry on them, you know? They don't have to go and say, like you're saying, it's a good thing we went on that 3-year mission together and went across 90 episodes.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. No, like Bones is so good at it. He's so well established. DeForest Kelly is so well established in that character. You know who he is right away. I mean, Sulu's not in it a lot, but you know who he is from his, you know, response. It's just, yeah, they're great. Great cast.
Yeah, they just know what they're like. That's just like understanding the assignment, right? Like they just show up and they're like, oh yeah, I'm doing this, got it.
Yeah.
Which
I wish I wish more movies would do. I mean, you don't even have to have it built upon a series or an existing IP. If you just write good characters and have good actors, I mean, they'll create their own backstories. If you understand your character, that comes through in the performance, and we're not getting enough of that in a lot of films today, which is so annoying.
This is an insane example of this, but this is one of my favorite, like, an actor creating their backstory things is Michael Keaton in The Other Guys. He has this thing, there's like this running gag with him where he keeps accidentally quoting TLC lyrics, like, very directly. But he doesn't know. And I saw an interview with him where he said that, like, he wrote a backstory for why his character keeps doing that, and it's because there's like a TLC great, like, his, it's, this is not referenced in the movie at all, and it's that he was driving his kid to college, and there was like a TLC greatest hit CD in the CD player, but as he was driving his kid to college, his kid was like coming out of the closet to him.
Oh my god.
And so and so he was too busy like having that conversation of like, okay, well, like, Yeah, and so he was just so the CD was on repeat the whole time, even on the way back, because he was like processing that his kid was coming out to him, and so he just never really locked into the music or bothered changing it, and it just got stuck in his subconscious, and that's why he does it. And it's like, my guy, you did not have to go that hard. Like,
that's stunning.
Holy shit!
I love that.
Yeah. That's props. I love that.
Yeah, it's so funny to think about, like, why would I be doing this? Okay, well, what if he had a kid? Like,
that's great.
I mean, I remember I spoke to my friend Slade, shout out to Slade.
Hey Slade,
who's a friend of the podcast, about when, like, I was writing my books and stuff like that, and, you know, like, some comments he made about, like, the writing and the dialogue is, like, giving characters, like, personality, like, that you could kind of, and the way I took it was basically, it's like, you could take this, like, line out of context, remove, like, the Magnus said, you know, mm-hmm. such and such or whatever, and if you just took that line out and you didn't know who was saying it, can you be able to, like, tell, you know, who
that's great advice.
Yeah.
You know?
That's super good advice.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that's how I took the advice that he was making. And so, like, I tried then, therefore, like, ever since then, like, think about that. And when I'm thinking about, like, movies and stuff like that, and writing is, like, you know, could you just pluck this line of dialogue out and be able to be like, oh, that's a Kirk line? Or is that, and, like, I feel like this show, or this movie, like, passes that test.
Oh, 100%. Generally,
right? You know, you go get the Shakespeare line, and then you obviously know it's Chang. Mm-hmm. No, I'm joking. but, like, I think that that's kind of the sign of, like, good character work, good dialogue, good writing, at least on that front. I think that, like, that's something I'm always looking for these days.
Yeah, well, like, that Spock line that I referenced earlier, like, do you think we've gotten so old and, like, inflexible? Mm-hmm. Like, that's totally how Spock would approach a problem, right? Is he's just like, hey, is this an us problem? Or, you know, like, are we the baddies? Maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah, well, and I love that the movie is, like, willing to, you know, generally, like, they like to have sage characters be sagely, but in a way, he's also being confronted with the fact that he's maybe wrong about some stuff, right? Mm. His successor, it turned out to be not so great.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, he's not stagnant either. He's still being challenged, which I think is cool. It's not just Kirk is going through a journey in it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is a good movie.
Yeah.
So, I mean, anyway, I don't know if you guys have anything else to bring up, but that's kind of maybe my complicated reasoning for choosing this one over probably way more obvious ones from me.
No, I like it.
No, I mean, I think it makes a ton of sense. Like, it's a total Mike movie.
Yeah.
Like, as I was watching it, I was like, yeah, this makes sense. I'm really interested to watch your other one, because that one doesn't make sense to me, because it, like, I guess I don't have a baseline for
What's
it.
What's the other one?
The Straight Story.
Okay. Haven't watched it yet.
Yeah. Available on Disney Plus, at least according to my most recent knowledge of it.
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah. I haven't seen it literally in, it has to be like 25 years, so I don't know if it's going to hold up at all.
I mean,
it
stuck with you enough to where, like, you've really, like, kind of been pushy about it to me, like, that I need to see it. Like, it means something to you somewhere.
I mean, mostly jokingly, but this was an opportunity to go and, like, give myself an excuse to revisit it, to see, like, I'm a little afraid, actually, to go and revisit it.
This is exactly why I chose V for Vendetta. That's the exact same reasoning I chose V for Vendetta, and I'm really nervous about it.
Yeah. There's something there that I think still holds up and speaks to me. I can't speak to, like, anything else about the film, the technical aspects or anything like that. But
I mean, David Lynch isn't a bad filmmaker, so.
No, of course not. So anyway, it's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah. Did you guys have anything else about Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country?
No, go and check it out. And, you know, you might be a snob over some of these things. Oh, this is just for nerds or whatever. But
not,
I mean,
really,
I think,
though. Like, it's not. It doesn't have a bunch of, like, weird, like, Star Wars shit in it. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't have, like, a bunch of weird species names that you gotta, like. And then, you know, like, the I always hear, like, Conan being like, and then Gleek Glorp went to Glib Glob, and, like, there's almost none of that in this. Like, I know there's, like, Klingon or whatever, but they're well established enough in the zeitgeist that, like, you can deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to me, like, the more time goes on with, like, a lot of different media, the more I kind of just, like, see through, like, the surface level stuff of, like, it's space and wacky forehead ridge aliens. Right. And it's just, like, I just see it as, like, people in like a naval drama or a political right. drama, or you know what, like when I play like a video game, yeah, it takes place in a fantasy setting or whatever, but then yeah. like I see through it and I just kind of see like the pixels and like I'm thinking about the gameplay is like mm-hmm. is this compelling, and you know all that other stuff, all those trappings are nice and you want them to be like coherent and you know not contradictory and you know all that stuff, but like I just think of all that as like the cherry on top, but like yeah. I'm looking at, you know, is this thing like, does it have substance? Mm-hmm. And I think that this, the good Star Trek stuff does, and there's a lot of bad stuff, which is why the reason why if you're a tourist you go and find a friend
yeah.
who can sift through that shit, curate it for you.
Yeah, go, if you are new to Star Trek and you want to get into it, just go find a tour guide and let them be like, all right, watch this episode, skip that one, this one's okay, you can watch it if you want, like
right you know, oh you like this character, here's this, you like these kind of themes, watch that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because it's weird because I feel like Star Trek people are very self-aware in that sense. Mm-hmm. They're able to be like, oh yeah, that one sucked.
Yeah, that's the benefit though of episodic television, is that you can mm-hmm. just admit it.
Yeah,
you know, you can be like, yeah, that was a shitty episode.
Yeah,
and like you can move on because it doesn't reflect on the whole thing, versus yeah, there's some very defensive fans of certain series because it's like, man, if you allow like that aspect of that movie or this plot to be criticized, mm-hmm. like the whole house of cards falls.
Yeah.
Right, and so they have to defend the whole mothership as yeah. a result of it.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because even like Breaking Bad has a lot of episodes that I think are kind of weak sauce, especially in like season 2 and 3. Mm-hmm. And yeah, people won't hear a bad word about Breaking Bad, and it's like, no, it's kind of slow. Mm-hmm. Like it has yeah. some pacing issues, and it doesn't really figure Walt out until almost the end of season 3.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say, you know, end of season three and then onward is when the show like really starts peaking.
Yeah, it kicks in. And like the thing is, the reason I don't think it's a show you've got to stick with through those seasons is because there is really good stuff that happens throughout it too.
Yeah. It's not like 10 episodes of shittiness. It's right. like, you know, a weak episode here or there, or a weak mm-hmm. moment here or there, but overall you're still being entertained. It's those ones where it's like, oh, just sit through like 2 10 episode seasons and then it gets good, and they
yeah.
like all those are bad though.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, that's real stupid. And like even the twin stuff in season 3 I like don't care about really.
I really liked it at the time. I don't know if coming back to it I feel differently. That's what actually got me into the show, is I watched the episode my roommate at the time was watching like the episode where the twins were like targeting Hank, right?
That, and,
like,
is that was really the tense payoff episode. To them.
Yeah, and so because I thought of that episode being so badass, I guess yeah. I like the stuff that comes before it when mm-hmm. I actually watched it from the start.
Mm-hmm.
But I could see it being really corny and lame.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
without
just,
that like exposure.
Yeah, because I was watching it and I was just like, who the hell are these guys?
Yeah.
And then like I stopped watching it for so long that I had to go back and rewatch season 1 and 2. Because I had heard how good season 4 had gotten, and I was just like, man, I did like season 1 and 2, but the stuff with the twins was just so annoying and out of place to me, and I didn't know what had happened with Hank, and then I saw that episode, and it didn't justify all of it to me, but I was like, okay, at least the payoff is worth this. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But then I think the show sidelines Hank for too long after that.
That's true. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, but anyway, this is not a podcast about Breaking Bad, so I guess we should wrap it up. But yeah, Missy, did you have any final thoughts?
No, definitely watch it. Yeah, I think you guys kind of said it all. It doesn't require a ton of background knowledge about it. You can just kind of hop in and enjoy it for what it is and what it's trying to say. And it's, I'm blown away by the CGI and the effects for this being 1991. I think it looks really good.
Yeah, I was reading that they also wrote most of the script via email.
That's wild.
Oh yeah, like early email.
Mm-hmm.
Did email, wasn't it just invented around then?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's like, you know, like Usenet and stuff like that. You know,
yeah.
Forums and, yeah, wild.
Yeah, that's so crazy to me that they were able to do that.
Yeah, like one guy would write during the day and the other guy would write during the night or something mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah, because
it's cool.
Yeah. Because the director, like, he lived in Europe, and the guy he co-wrote the movie with lived in L.A.
Mm.
Yeah. It's cool. Like, it goes and shows that, you know, you could go and use those technologies and, you know, like, look, technology isn't all bad. You know, right. I'm afraid that like we're coming across with like, you know, or like Luddite in like our beliefs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it goes and shows that like these people could go and cooperate across, you know, the sea and all that stuff. Like, it's cool that like they were utilizing like advanced stuff at that time. Mm-hmm. To like the best of their abilities.
Yeah, I mean this show records in three different time zones.
Yeah. It's pretty true. Neat.
Yeah.
Well, thanks guys for watching it. I appreciate it.
Yeah. It was great.
Yep.
Great time.
Yeah. Until next time, Shakespeare and the original Klingon's the bad guy.